I have a dream.
One small step.
How many we say
the wall must go.
Diana, Princess of Wales.
Right into the World Trade Center.
Winner is Sydney.
This week in history.
This week in history, and not so long ago, the world's first successful supersonic passenger plane, the Concorde, made a major achievement, its first transatlantic crossing on September the 26th, 1973. Now, a few years later, the New York to London or Paris flight was a regular occurrence, with the mega-rich rock and movie stars and corporate executives enjoying the best of aviation's high life, crossing the Atlantic in 3 hours, travelling at supersonic speeds nearly 60,000 feet above the Earth. And for more than a quarter of a century, the Concorde was a regular part of the passenger plane travel.
There at the end of the runway is Concorde 001, and in Toulouse has joined Raymond Baxter.
110 tons of aircraft, all up, wait there.
Nose come up to 20 degrees, she's airborne. She flies.
The Concorde was special. The quality of the work, the minds, the skill, the talent, the commitment that went into it, that's what really matters.
Welcome to Concorde and our supersonic operation from London's Heathrow to New York's John F. Kennedy.
Here we are, ladies and gentlemen, we're through Mark 1, the speed of sound, no bumps, no bangs, Concorde.
Concorde has captured the imagination of people from all over the world. An extraordinary feat of engineering. A unique blend of power, grace, beauty.
Well, then in 2000, a Concorde caught fire on takeoff and crashed. The airlines operating it found it too expensive to continue, and its final passenger flight took place on October the 23rd, 2003. So tonight, a look back at the history of this amazing, beautiful, yet troubled aircraft. And joining us from the UK is Jonathan Glancy, aviation and architectural writer who wrote Concorde, The Rise and Fall of the Supersonic Airline. Jonathan, welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks very much, Indira.
I need to ask you straight off, were you ever lucky enough to actually fly on a Concorde?
I certainly did. I flew it twice. And in fact, the second time was that very last flight from New York to London. So I remember that flight extremely well.
What was it like?
Well, Concorde was like a sort of a magnificent GT grand touring sports car with wings. Mm. Or if you like, a kind of super stylish and big executive jet designed to a standard that was way beyond that of conventional airliners. And it was utterly, it was a beautiful thing in every way. Could people inside actually see the beauty of it? Not quite, but you certainly experienced something very exciting, which was the way this aircraft took off. Indira, it shot off down the runway at enormous speed, and you could feel the thrust of the afterburners pushing you into your seat. And that was something very, very different from a conventional airline. And you knew you were in for a special journey.
All right. Well, let's go back to the idea of the Concorde and how it became something from the pipe dream that it started with. Now, Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier in 1947. But when did the idea, Jonathan, for a passenger plane traveling at supersonic speeds get serious attention?
It's an extraordinarily long, complicated story, Indira, but to make it very simple, the Germans have been working on these ideas in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting that when the British got very keen on this post-Second World War, and it's almost immediately after the Second World War, they brought into the British aircraft establishment at Farnborough, the research establishment, two key German aerodynamicists. So it was a project that had been going on amongst the best scientists and aerodynamicists in Europe. And it was in Britain, which in 1949 had created the first jet airline, the Comet, that things gelled. And really, to cut to the chase, the first serious proper official meeting was in 1956. This was the Supersonic Transport Aircraft Committee.
I love the name.
Really, it's great, isn't it? STAC. Well, it's, you know, they always have the, you know, this typical stuff. But, you know, STAC was founded on 5th of November 1956. That's Guy Fawkes Day, or Fireworks Day in Britain. The blue paper was touched, lit, and the Concorde project took off.
Mm. Now, there was this huge rivalry around this time, wasn't there, between Britain and France, the US, the Soviets. They were all planning their own versions of these supersonic passenger planes. But how did this very unlikely marriage between the British and the French aerospace industries, how did that come about, Jonathan?
Oh, a mixture of politics and technology. Technology first. Remember, the French had been the allies of the British in the Second World War, and they knew each other's aircraft inside out. The French were also really good at aircraft design and were pushing supersonic military aircraft and very advanced forms in the 1950s. But the actual key reason was this. That committee we mentioned, STAC, produced its big report in 1959, that laid out the design of a supersonic airliner. Now, the British government just gave that report to the French, and the French then worked on their version. And when the engineers from France and Britain met in 1961 for the first time, surprise, surprise, these two designs from France and Britain were pretty much exactly the same. Why did the British do this thing? They wanted to join, the British government wanted to join the new European Economic Community, the EEC, the precursor of the EU. And that's why they did it. So it's politics, really. Concorde was the price to pay for Britain joining the EEC.
Right. Now, it's interesting you talk about Britain and France being allies, because as you would have been following, Australians have very recently been dealing with the French on this joint project involving a terminated submarine project. But there would have been so many more bigger hurdles back in the 70s, you know, with the British and the French working together, the language barriers, the metric versus imperial measurement and the suspicions. It's incredible that all of that was overcome.
When the French and British engineering teams met up for the first time face-to-face in 1961, they didn't speak each other's languages very well, if at all. But for their first day together, they went out on the town. They went out to restaurants and to glamorous nightclub, and they had a really good time. And the next morning, they sat down together and compared notes. It is a remarkable thing that these teams worked together so well. And what was interesting, and what the engineers themselves say, and I've spoken to both sides, the French and the British, they say that there was a wonderful competitive spirit. So the French would say, you know, for example, we must do this. And the British would say, oh, no, you won't. We should do this. And then they would argue. And the arguments were good, because they sharpened the minds and sharpened the project. So you got the best out of everybody by really almost fighting playfully on the design of the machine. But as you said, the drawings, very interesting, two sets of drawings, one set in metric, one set in imperial measurements. Today, that wouldn't matter at all, because computers can sort out any measurement you like. The idea that you need digital metric measurements for computers is nonsense. Computers can do with any measurements you want to put into them. But at the time, it required colossal discipline. And did it make the project longer than if one country had done it? Yes, of course it did.
I've got some audio demonstrating this cooperation.
At Lancaster House, the aviation minister, Mr. Julian Amery, in company with the French ambassador, almost crooned in admiration over the brainchild of their two countries. On behalf of their governments, they signed the agreement for the joint development and production, a foretaste, perhaps, of common market cooperation.
Monsieur Frappesh, how often do you go to Bristol?
I go into Bristol every 2 weeks, and I stay for 3 days.
Of course, we had the language problem. A lot of the French spoke some form of English, whereas very few of the English spoke any French.
Do you speak French?
Very little, just enough to get by for food and such like.
Drawings were in French, and we all learned what a drill was, or what a bolt was, or nuts or split pins. We kind of got used to the French terms.
France's Concorde workers take their lunchtime break.
And here at the Sud Aviation Works at Toulouse, it's very different indeed from the British Aircraft Corporation's canteen at Filton. Most French workmen like to take a glass of wine with their lunch.
The technique was quite good because they would stonewall all morning, then give you a good lunch, and then they'd expect you to accept their proposal in the afternoon. That's scurrilous, I suppose, yeah.
But scurrilous, a glass of wine for lunch, Jonathan.
La la.
It's just incredible. You're listening to Nightlife with Indira Naidoo, and for our This Week in History, we're reliving how this extraordinary concept, the Concorde, came about with my guest, UK historian Jonathan Glancy, aviation and architectural writer. His book, Concorde, The Rise and Fall of the Supersonic Airliner. All right, Jonathan, so we've got to this stage where they've got together, they're collaborating, they've overcome their traditional rivalry. Now tell me about the Concorde's name, because this is a great story, because French President Charles de Gaulle first used the title, but he added the E on the end, and that put out a few noses, a few British noses.
Well, Indira, I hate to be pedantic and correct you. The story is slightly different.
Oh.
The name Concorde, the French spelling with the E on the end, it came from England. It came from the British engineers building the aircraft. They wanted to call it Concorde. And it was British government ministers and Whitehall bureaucrats who said, oh, no, we can't have this froggy name. You know, it's all Frenched off. You've got to take the E off, you know, old chap, and call it Concorde, make it English. Well, more British. And that's where things got a bit tricky, because what happened was the engineering company, British Aircraft Corporation, they put out all their press releases and so on with the name Concorde with an E, whilst official government documents didn't have the E.
Right.
Strange stuff. Now, General de Gaulle, of course, would have the E. And then the problem was resolved when the very first pre-production Concorde 001 was unveiled at Toulouse in 1967. And Anthony Wedgwood Benn, whose voice we heard earlier, I noticed in your recording, who was Britain's Minister of Technology at the time, he announced the plane is going to be called Concorde, he said, with an E. It's going to stand for E for excellence, England, Europe, and Entente. And he got, it's very clever, but India, he got criticism, of course, immediately from sort of angry Scots calling in the, you know, the BBC and so on, saying, how dare he say, you know, England, when it's a British aircraft. And Ben came back brilliantly and he said, oh, no, the E also stands for Écosse, which is the French for Scotland. Very nice.
Right, I
and
see.
It became, and so that was the story, and it became Concorde from then on.
With the E. All right. So we're moving into the 1970s now, Jonathan, and it's beginning to look like this plane is going to be a huge success. What was the attitude of the world's airlines? Did it capture their imaginations? Did they want some Concordes in their fleets?
Completely. Supersonic was the way to go. It was the future. And many airlines, I mean, really a lot of them, 16 to begin with, and then more, put in orders for Concordes. The British and the French expected to build at least 74 Concordes. Uh-huh. In the end, they built 20, of only which 14 were ever in service. But it looked pretty rosy, and it would have been profitable at those numbers. So, yes, everybody was excited. And to the point where, very interestingly, Concorde made its maiden flight in 1969, and Boeing launched its jumbo jet, the 747, that same year, within weeks. And Boeing was very worried that Concorde would steal the market for long-distance passenger travel, and the jumbo jet would end up being a freighter rather than a passenger aircraft. Well, interesting, isn't it? Things didn't quite turn out that way.
No. Isn't it lovely? Oh, I love the 747. So my favourite plane.
Oh, 747 is fantastic.
Yeah.
But they're chalk and cheese.
Yeah,
you know,
completely.
Concorde, 747,
completely.
Yeah.
So, all right. So this prototype is widely marketed and even comes here to Australia. And I'm sure we'd have a few listeners tonight who remembered seeing it in Australian skies on those promotional flights, because that sonic boom, that was the big issue, wasn't it, Jonathan? There were broken windows and remote communities were disturbed.
Well, this actually had come up very early. When Britain was testing various high-speed planes in the 50s, the first
aircraft, a military prototype that to break the 1,000 mile an hour barrier, you know, which is way past the speed of sound, flew along the south coast of Britain. And whilst it was a tremendous technological success, guess what? Thousands of windows were smashed. Mm. And that led to Britain banning supersonic flights over the mainland. So that's Britain, the country that's actually promoting this. So when, for example, I mean, Qantas wanted to order 4 Concordes, and they imagined flying them from Sydney to London, and they would stop off on the way at, oh gosh, let me try and remember that. They stop off at Darwin, Singapore, Calcutta, Karachi, and Cairo.
That's a lot of windows.
On the way to London. So a lot of, yeah, but when you look at the map, so imagine the map in front of your eyes now, everybody, yeah. And you'd see that the aircraft's not flying over the water that much. And so when you go to India, it's a problem, or Cairo. And in fact, the Indian government made it very clear, we're not having aircraft flying supersonic over India, over the Indian mainland. And the Egyptians said the same. So that potential flight, Qantas flight, never happened. And Qantas never did order Concordes. They ordered jumbo jets instead. And, but you can see it was such a problem. Because I don't know if you've ever heard a supersonic bang.
I have.
Yeah, and it's really, really loud.
Yes,
it's like a
very disturbing
huge gun going off, and it actually just go bang. You know, you can't live with that. You don't hear us in the aircraft, of course.
Yeah, interesting. All right, so it was not to be for Qantas, but so we've now come to 1973 in September, this week in history, Jonathan, a transatlantic flight around 3 hours. What did that moment of success mean for Concorde?
It meant that Concorde could do what it was designed to do. It was built really to fly the North Atlantic route from Paris and London to New York and Washington. And now it was proved it could do it. And by the way, it was always a very marginal exercise in Europe because Concorde could just carry enough fuel to make that journey. So that the whole project had been this balancing act between, you know, fuel, weight, and distance. Really, Concorde might have gone on to make decent sums of money if it could have flown the Pacific, but it couldn't have done so. It just couldn't carry enough fuel. And if it did carry enough fuel, it'd be a colossal great aircraft.
Mm. And when did it become a regular service, Jonathan?
That was in 1977. Mm. And then you could travel from Paris and London to New York. Wonderful to have the choice as well. The aircraft were interesting, quite different. The French versions inside had these rather grand sort of deluxe interiors with big sort of squishy armchairs, really, about as big as you could fit into the small airframe, whilst the British ones were more matter of fact.
That goes without saying. Exactly.
Goes without saying.
I'm chatting to Jonathan Glancy. He's an aviation and architectural writer about this week in history, that first transatlantic flight of the Concorde, 1973 in September. All right, Jonathan, so it's up and running across this transatlantic route. The British and French military initially, as you mentioned, offered quite different services. The French was a little bit more luxurious, champagne, caviar. Who were the passengers initially of these flights?
Business people. I mean, Concorde obviously became well known for carrying film stars and other celebrities, and they certainly used it a lot. But if you got on any particular day, if you'd been lucky enough to do so, you'd find nearly everybody on there was a business person. It mattered enormously to them because they could go to face-to-face meetings, which are always more effective even today than using Zoom and everything else. But more importantly than that, they could get to meetings without jet lag. And if you're flying from London to New York and vice versa, certainly coming back, there's always this rather sad thing. You arrive back feeling groggy, the jet lag. Concorde flew so fast, the time difference didn't work that same way. You just step off the aircraft feeling fresh as a daisy.
Right. So even flying that fast through the air, you didn't end up getting any sort of wooziness or anything like that.
No jet. Well, alcohol.
Alcohol.
I mean, Concorde. One of the interesting things about Concorde is that during the development process, Indira, the British engineers in particular got worried that the aircraft was putting on weight. during the development process, which it did. It was a much heavier machine than originally intended because the airlines, and not necessarily the French and the British, actually, it was the other airlines, all the others, including Qantas, who said, this is a luxury airliner. It needs luxury catering. And so we need a big galley to serve lots of wonderful, delicious food and not just give people a cheese sandwich.
Yeah, I like that. That's my type of flight, definitely. And what became interesting, Jonathan, is that it suddenly became profitable because people started chartering these Concordes.
That was absolutely extraordinary. It was realised that actually not just that Concorde was extremely popular amongst the public. Of course, there were always protesters about the noise and so on. But for the general public, and this meant pretty much around large parts of the world, Concorde was very popular because it was so beautiful and exciting and special. Mm. And the charter flights were extraordinary things. They allowed, you know, people on, you know, modest earnings and salaries to fly in this beautiful machine. And it would do trips like, you know, take off from Heathrow and fly around the Bay of Biscay around Spain. Or at Christmas, they would do Father Christmas flights to the north of Finland. You know, come and see Father Christmas and go and see him by Concorde. I mean, it's quite bizarre stuff in a way, but it did allow a huge number of people who weren't, you know, megastars, celebrities and captains of industry to fly on this brilliant plane.
So how expensive would it be normally, Jonathan, to buy a ticket on the Concorde?
About twice as much as a normal first-class fare. So, you know, whatever the fare is today, double it. So very expensive. But it seemed to be cost-effective to big businesses for the things we've talked about, that you could, you know, a senior executive could jet across the Atlantic quickly and even go there from London to New York and back in a day. You know, having had a very important meeting in the middle, which might have meant, you know, a deal of millions of dollars, which also might have meant, you know, hundreds of thousands of jobs, who knows? So it was cost effective for companies that way.
Yeah. All right. So it's all seemingly going very, very well. And then, of course, that awful moment, a Concorde crashes, flight 4590 in July 2000. I still remember that moment. I mean, I think anyone who was around then remembers the horror of that moment and those crash pictures. What did it mean for Concorde's viability?
It was a disaster. The French used it very much as the excuse, in a way, they've been looking for Air France to get rid of Concorde, as Concorde was a one-off, expensive to maintain, requires special parts and so on, and particular servicing. This was a way to get rid of it. The rather tragic thing is that Concorde was and still is, by the way, if you look historically, one of the very safest passenger aircraft ever built. It just didn't kill people. The one time it did was in Paris in that July 2000. And it was really, the more one looks at it at that day, the more one looks at it, one thinks, yeah, there were maintenance problems with that aircraft. It was overloaded. It was carrying too much fuel. It was absolutely, you know, and it was jammed the gunnels of people on this flight to New York. I know that wasn't the direct cause of the accident, which was the aircraft's tires hitting a piece of metal on the runway, but there was something slightly wrong with the aircraft. It hadn't been looked after properly. And of course, people still talk about it in aviation circles because it was the, you know, that moment when this beautiful, magnificent machine would come truly tumbling out of the sky for good.
Yeah. You're listening to ABC Radio. This is Indira and I Do with Nightlife. For our This Week in History, we're looking at the September the 26th, 1973, when the Concorde, the world's first successful supersonic passenger plane, made its debut crossing across the transatlantic crossing. Sadly, we are now looking at that terrible crash in Paris in 2000. And then everything started to really fall apart for Concorde. Jonathan, when did the service stop then?
The French stopped it at the time of that, at the crash at Gonesse in Paris. The British Airways loved Concorde very much indeed, and wanted, there were arguments in the company, of course, over Concorde, but it had strong supporters, and it was actually, the aircraft were refurbished, both technically and in terms of passenger accommodation. They're very, very smart in their last couple of years. And they flew on to October 2003 and were much loved. You know, it's a tricky one. And in the end, so why did it stop? Was it just the French accident? It was more than that. Then here come the, I nearly said the perfidious French again, your best friends in Australia. The Airbus, now the great big successful European aircraft manufacturing company based in France, Airbus suddenly decided after the French crash, we will no longer supply you with spare parts. British Airways, you can do what you like, but we're not going to manufacture the spare parts. Right. Well, you can imagine if you're driving a very fancy sports car and, you know, your Ferrari or your Lamborghini or whatever, and the company says we're no longer going to make, you know, the fuel injection system or whatever it is, you're not going to be able to drive that car, are you? That's what happened to Concorde. So the British aircraft that were still flying in 2003 were in superb condition. And they, as any of the pilots or engineers or the airline executives have told you, they could have flown happily for another 10, 15 years.
Really? Oh, that is quite tragic, isn't it? So then, Jonathan, how remarkable was the Concorde? Where's its place in aviation history?
It's one of the most remarkable aircraft, one of the most remarkable machines built in the 20th century, and it still is one of the most exciting aircraft. And the reason for that is that this team of superbly brilliant engineers created an aircraft that could fly at sensational speed, Mach 2, at sensational height, and come down very safely to land, the aircraft flying in circles with slow airline traffic, landing calmly. It could take people up faster than a jet fighter without using afterburners in cruise flight. And people could sit there and they could sleep and read and chat and drink their champagne in total peace and quiet, whilst all this thunderous ministry of technology and all the elements roaring around this aircraft, which is heating up like bilio. Now, if you touch the surface of Concorde, you take your skin off straight away. And the aircraft actually expanded in flight. It got longer in flight because of the heat. All that ingenuity to create that machine was something that's never happened in the aircraft industry since.
Oh, yes, it was a beautiful thing, that's for sure.
There's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, there's now talk, Jonathan, about a new supersonic plane. Flights between Sydney and Los Angeles in under 7 hours is the dream being offered by this Colorado-based aviation company, Boom Supersonic. What's the likelihood of that ever happening?
It's possible. I mean, money speaks, doesn't it? I mean, if you throw enough money at something, it will happen. You know, you can fly into space now, can't you, if you, as a tourist, if you want to, and you're willing to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars. So really, it's totally possible. But I think there's a certain sadness in it, and that the moment's gone, that what Concorde was compared to these new suggestions, Concorde was a big everyday commercial airliner. These things are like super executive jets, really, you know. They're not the same thing. They're not big airline aircraft. And I think that's what Concorde did so well. You know, it mixed it with jumbo jets and Comets and 707s. It was a part of everyday transport, very special. These ones are more sort of, you know, executive toys.
Jonathan, you were very lucky to have flown it twice. Very lucky indeed. And thank you
very
so
lucky.
Much for sharing with us this, yes, as you said, this extraordinary piece of machinery. And, we were lucky enough to at least see it in action, even if most of us didn't get to fly in it. It's been great chatting. Thanks a lot, Jonathan.
You too. Thanks, Indira, very much indeed.
Jonathan Glancy, who's an aviation and architectural writer who wrote the book Concorde, The Rise and Fall of the Supersonic Airliner, joining us for our This Week in History.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.